if we can, Alice, I think we've probably made a good start on our gap analysis thinking about policy, and it, of course it strayed into implementation. Can we just do another round of gap analysis thinking about issues that we've highlighted in our discussion paper, things like proxy privacy, applicable laws, compliance enforcement, thinking about issues like data accuracy, does ICANN have sufficient powers to do what it wants to do with to effectively enforce its existing commitments? Do we know what's going on elsewhere in the landscape, for example, in CCTLDs? What are the barriers, costs or otherwise, to compliance? This sort of thing. So should we just start to kick around some more gaps on and if we need to prompt ourselves, have a look back at our discussion paper and remembering that we're finishing this by 3. Bill, thank you.
So as I recall, we did say proxy privacy somewhere was... We wanted to put a forward reference or something. So, I have very little understanding of those services, but it certainly isn't clear to me that they're truly covered in the policy.
So we've got a bid for proxy privacy somewhere in our gap analysis. Peter, did you want to come in?
I would like to see proxy privacy in there somewhere. And one is a question about how are they dealt with? Is it clear how they are dealt with in the existing policy framework? And I guess similar to the potential gap that exists with resellers. Are they captured in the contractual / regulatory net? Are they able to be touched? And if not, I think that's a gap.
And just to highlight the other gap that we highlighted earlier, there we feel that there's a gap somewhere about resellers. We think that might be a compliance gap rather than a contractual gap. James?
I'd like to examine there is an operational gap relative to who is, in that the parties that are required to have a WHOIS system that is both responsive and available, it's particularly in inter-registrar operations such as transfers. We notice that there's a disparity between how registrars will operate. You know, for example, a mature and large registrar might have very sophisticated WHOIS systems that are available 24/7, while other ones might go down periodically for days or months at a time. So, you know, I think operationally this can be an impediment to the free transfer of domain names between registrars, and I think that we should take a look at whether or not the current policy permits ICANN to take action in those cases where a registrar WHOIS system simply is just not available.
Thank you. Lynn?
Yeah, I think we need to address the thick and thin WHOIS, because the WHOIS policy doesn't, in my mind, permit a thin WHOIS. So why is thin WHOIS permitted? Why is it allowed?
Can I just jump in on that one? Is the thick and thin WHOIS really is a determining of who holds the contact data, not whether it's held. So I think that I don't see an incompatibility between what's required of WHOIS versus the model. I think operationally it poses problems for registrars, thin registries, but I don't see them as being any more or less of a problem than other.
Well, maybe this comes back to someone having to look up WHOIS data that, you know, if you're the person looking up who is data and you first go to a thin who is, and then you go through steps there, and then you get to the registrar and get to the thick, I mean, why shouldn't you be able to just look it up and find the data in one spot?
So maybe the gap we're identifying here, Lynn, is your point earlier, a while earlier, was about ease of use for the uninitiated and getting the data. Sharon?
Yeah, I think I was going to say that it is so overly complex. And I think the reason why this hasn't been exposed before is because most members of the public or users so far wouldn't know really what Whois is, let alone want to exploit it. But as more and more people go online and there's more domains and everyone's... people are going to need to do this easily, and I think that this review we're doing is a real opportunity to propose that this needs to be a lot simpler. People would expect something like a directory, telephone directory, not 3 hours of trying to plough your way through and going around in circles and circles until you give up. So I think we need to expose that.
There is an ease of use point. Bill, I apologise, I skipped you in the queue.
I'll pass for the moment because I've forgotten what I wanted to say. So.
I think, Alice, if I could just ask to capture this sense of ease of use and perhaps I could also suggest that it goes back to the theme we had, James, okay, the theme we had about communication as perhaps a gap. When we're looking at the effectiveness of the implementation of policy. Peter, then James, and then... Oh, Bill's remembered what he was going to say, so shall we go Bill, Peter?
Yes.
Bill,
before I forget,
James,
yeah.
Peter.
It's around SLAs, and it was to James' point. I think there are gaps there, and any number of them. So SLAs would capture James's point, I think there are other things as well. When, as an example, when we want to, if we need to do a takedown because we've got a phishing site or whatever, yeah, we run into problems where we have sites. Oh, I'm sorry, it's 5:05 p.m. local Friday. We won't be back until, you know, Tuesday because we have a national holiday on Monday and we're closed over the weekend. Right. Those types of things is there are we PayPal would like to see some SLAs in the agreements and that we could rely on.
Okay, so Alice, that's SLAs, and I think if we just put disparity amongst registrars, which was James's point, I think that disparity of service levels between registrars. So, yes.
The other thing from our perspective is, on some of these, is the amount of time that is allowed. We understand why, you know, in some cases there needs to be a longer period of time, but frankly, if we're looking at a phishing site for some action on it, if it isn't done within a matter of hours on the outside, it's almost not worth doing. The half-life of a fish site is 24 hours.
So there's timeliness of response. Sorry, Peter, then Susan.
I just wanted to, I think...
James, I'm sorry.
This was next in the queue. I'm losing it. James, Peter, Susan.
See, we need some ice quickly so we can get that Diet Coke caffeinated. Because there's a sitting over there, warm and so really quickly, Bill, I think you're right on the money with the SLAs, and I was trying not to say that specifically, but hint at it. Now you're, I think, also getting into just a general abuse handling and responsiveness issue, which is a much bigger story. So I would like to touch on something else. We have, I think, as a group, not been shy about talking about what to do about registrars who are not giving up the goods to people who need their WHOIS data. But I'm going to turn this around a little bit. There is an escalating and quiet, silent arms race, if not an all-out shooting war, between registrars and registries and other folks who are very, very clever and very, very sophisticated at harvesting WHOIS and mechanically crawling WHOIS zones and automated systems to gather gather contact data. Now, we are, I believe, in our existing policies and probably law, depending on where you hang out your shingle, are obligated to, by ICANN, to show the WHOIS data upon request, but also to protect the WHOIS data. It's a two-sided coin, you know, a dual responsibility to provide that service, but also to be responsible with that service. And I think that we should take a look at, does the existing policy provide sufficient protections for registrars who are engaged in the responsible management and, I'm going to say, metered and responsible access to their WHOIS data? Are they given the sufficient protections under the existing policy? So how do we put that in a bullet point?
That's your answer, James. but it is I think that's a huge area which we probably haven't given enough airtime to, about I know that there's, I think we're all conscious that there's a study on WHOIS abuse which goes part of the way to it. I think the other side of that is, why are people doing this? You know, are they doing it for illegitimate reasons, or are they doing it because they feel that they need the data in one place? This is Lynn's point, without having to go all over the place, or what is the reason? So I don't want
the
to
The short answer is they're selling it, but I'll just leave that.
Okay, right. And in the interest of time, because we've got 15 more minutes on this, and re-establishing the queue, Peter, Susan, Bill, I see wanting to come in. Anyone else?
So James may well have just answered the question I had, which was on his point about disparities between different registrars. I was going to come in with a question saying, is the issue a contractual issue, in that there aren't requirements in the contract that deal with that concern, or is it a compliance issue that no one's potentially dealing with the registrars who aren't doing anything? I'm not sure if the SLA's answer does it captures it, but one thing I think we should be aware of here is, if to use James's example as a classic case, like if there are large or good actor registrars who are doing the right thing, and then there are small registrars or bad actor registrars who are not, I think as a review team we should be very careful to ensure that we are incentivizing good behavior. So if I understand James correctly, there are some people doing the potentially right thing, some people not. As a review team, we should be looking to incentivize the people doing the right thing, as well as necessarily doing enforcement against the other side. I think we should be looking at both sides, because I think that'll be an important thing for us going forward in crafting our recommendations and getting the support of the community. So it's something to keep in mind.
I've noted that. And I think that you're right when we come on to the recommendations bit, which we're going to do after Susan's intervention.
Well, just to back to Lynn's point, that why is there a thick WHOIS and a thin WHOIS and ease of use, maybe that's something we might want to put in a recommendation. I understand this is going to be very controversial, but why doesn't the registry control it? Why isn't there a central source? I know a lot of the arguments on that, but... you know, that might, if we could come to an agreement on that, that might be a solution to make the WHOIS or give one entity an ability to actually make the WHOIS accurate and validate the accuracy. There's a lot of the registrars would argue against that, I'm sure, but and then on James' point, basically I'm assuming you're talking about aggregators, James. And so, yes, people are harvesting WHOIS, but on a day-to-day basis, I use two different companies' tools that do that and could not do the enforcement that I need to do and protect our users in the way that we are. We're pretty limited anyway in protecting our users because of the invalid whois without those aggregators. So although that may have been the point of the policy at one point, maybe we need to reevaluate the policy, and the policy needs to be updated to today's needs of the market. These entities have created a product that is, you know, I mean, sure, there's other aggregations that may not be as helpful, but it's sort of a market response to a need of a product.
Thank you. So how do we capture the last few things? I noticed that we haven't identified a gap on data accuracy. Are we saying there is no gap on data accuracy?
Yeah, that's good.
Okay, should we put that in?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to go, please?
Okay. So I wanted to agree with James that basically on the if we're looking at abuse, we need to look at it really sort of from all parties. Okay, so I think that is something we should do. To Susan's point, yeah, because of certain situations that the ecosystem has allowed, there now are these aggregators and other things that are providing useful services to some that we would think are arguably are appropriate and not an abuse, but those same services could be used in a different way that is abusive. So, and on the accuracy, is that a policy issue, or I actually think it's both policy and implementation potentially.
I think what we're doing is kind of ending up just throwing out all the gaps that we can think of, because a lot of these are about implementation as well. So let's just not be too fussy at this stage and get them out onto the paper, I think, is probably the way to go. I don't think we've captured this point that we've started to discuss, which is about data harvesting and the fact that on one level the data harvesting breaches Whois fair use terms. On the other hand, some of those people who are harvesting the data are providing people with the only tools that they can use to do their job. That is a situation where there's a problem, surely. Sarmad, then James. James, go first.
I just wanted to respond to that somewhat because, you know, the fact that the service provided by aggregators is useful, I'm sure that the people who are selling male enhancement drugs believe that the services provided by spammers are also useful. So I would like that not to be necessarily the criteria for something being allowable. For example, in our Whois terms of service, it very clearly says that what they're doing is wrong and is a violation of the terms of service that we've set forth in our Whois system. So it is an abuse from our perspective, plain and simple. What is done with it, whether it's done to initiate a phishing attack or whether it's done to help people protect their intellectual property marks, it's kind of irrelevant. They're violating our terms of services. Yes.
I think that the issue for us as a review team is what is the alternative for, and now we've already in our kind of stakeholder analysis, we've already said that people use the Whois for, let's call it law enforcement or enforcement of private rights. If there is no other way of them getting those tools, then, you know, that's a gap, is it? It's not so. How do we square that circle? Because you're right, they're right.
Well, you know, if you think about it, if the policy was consistently implemented and the Whois data was consistently accurate and publicly available and wasn't so difficult to obtain, companies like Susan wouldn't have to resort to these aggregators. Okay, so they're resorting to that as a workaround because the current policy implementation is so bad.
to come in again, because okay. I think he's going to...
there's a
vein on your forehead.
No. This is good. I just wanted to point out, there's something that's very, very, I think, an important and a very key distinction here, which is we're not talking about who is information or contact information as a domain registration sits today. Aggregators are doing something different. They're selling history, okay? And that is not within the definition. And that is, I think, extremely valuable information as a product or as an information service, but it is an abuse of our systems to acquire and compile that archived data system. So
right, I'm just going to, because we can spend the rest of the afternoon very usefully on this, but we're not going to do what we wanted to do. How are we going to capture this so that we can remember it and revisit it? Can we just talk about harvesting WHOIS, aggregators and stuff, and that will be, I'm sure that we'll then spark and remember what we were talking about. Bill?
I'd like to understand, so take a little more time on this, if we could, what the acceptable use policy is, and why an aggregator is in breach. Are they in breach because they provide a service, or would it be a breach of your acceptable use policy if I went and obtained information and kept a history on my own? Is that an abuse of current policy?
I've got Samad waiting to come in on this thing. We're going to finish this section at 3, and we haven't got to the recommendations yet, so...
So I have two concerns. It's not about the content. This is good content. It's about the how this content is actually related to legitimate needs of law enforcement and promotion of consumer trust. That's really what we are after.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Samad, but there's the other elements as well, which are how is the policy and implementation effective and blah, blah, blah. So okay. I think that quite a few...
Right. So what I was going to say was that we need to eventually tie these things up to those particular things somehow. From an implementation point of view. And the second question, which was just coming to me, was that suppose that the policy was realized or implemented to the last detail, would it legitimately cover the legitimate need of law enforcement and promote consumer trust, or there is any gap in policy which actually is still lacking, and is there something we need to think about as well?
So are you saying, I think that's a very good steer for us at this stage to remember the lens that we're meant to be looking at this stuff through is in part promoting consumer trust and meeting the legitimate needs of law enforcement. So as we're doing our gap analysis, as we're making our recommendations, we should be saying, you know, each of these actions should be contributing to one or the other.
So that's the first part. The second part was that if the policy as defined at this time is actually realized as it is defined, does it really meet those two goals?
So can we put a marker down now to say extent to which policy meets needs of law enforcement and promotes consumer trust?
That's also a gap in policy, but it may not be an implementation issue.
Yeah. And I think we'll get the information through Sharon's study and through our Hope to study.
Having just, I was looking through the issues paper and the quotes in the AOC, just wanted to add a couple of things to the points we've already got there. So for the privacy proxy one, the current question we've got there, is it clear and how is it captured by the current policy contractual framework? In terms of a gap, we've got the AOC stating that there is a requirement for unrestricted and public access. So I think that there is going to be a tension between privacy proxy and unrestricted and public access. So if we could reflect that as a potential gap tension. And the other thing which is in the...
Sorry, Alice, did you get that? There's a... So up there where the cursor is, we could say interplay with unrestricted public access.
Yep, that's right. And for the point on the SLA agreements, I think one of the things Bill talked about there was timeliness. And I note in the AOC, again, we've got timely. So if we could actually reflect that as a sub-point, just to be clear about what at least one element which really should be there. I mean, it's not that we think it should be there. The AOC mentions this word.
Anybody want to come in with anything else? I think, although we haven't gone through the recommendations, from what I've heard around the table, we are assuming that the gaps that we identify will lead logically to recommendations to fill those gaps. But just in the last few minutes, is there anything we haven't captured that we think we need to be making recommendations on? James?
I'm going to struggle with this one just a little bit, but there was a very healthy discussion, I believe, in London relative to what the existing policy may or may not be providing when we start to talk about non-ASCII IDN, who is data, and internationalized character sets, and does the existing policy fit the bill? And I really lost the handle on that topic sometime between London and now.
Yeah, this is something that SARMAT has consistently raised. We haven't adequately explored. Before I come to you, Bill, can I just say that it's something highlighted in the accuracy study as one of the major reasons for inaccurate data is actually just simply the translation between ASCII and non-ASCII in the contact details in some cases, or that's my understanding of it. So,
and further that, okay, we have a requirement for port 43 WHOIS in the existing policy. Port 43 is not defined outside of ASCII, so it gets very, you know, it's almost like in order to support some of the non-character sets, we'll have to break the RA. It's
so can we put non-ASCII character sets as a marker down? I think Bill wants to expand on that. I've got SARMAD and Lynn too.
Right, so to James's point, port 43 who is service is I believe is required to be 7-bit clean. So it'll be ASCII. And that going forward, certainly, even now with IDNs, is a huge gap. Okay? And so we should mention it. I don't know that we can have a recommendation on it. There is something I want to note, and that is the fact that ICANN has hosted discussions on the technical evolution of WHOIS. There now is an IETF discussion. I think technically it's a discussion group where some documents have been IETF drafts are out for conversation. They're talking about requirements and lots of other things are coming up. And I actually have some, and I think we may want to offline talk about this, but some serious concerns about the direction those conversations are going and the mess it might leave us in as a community.
So to capture the gap on the non-ASCII characters, you could just say evolution of technical standard and that, I think, will remind us of this conversation. So I have Samad, then Lynn. Does anybody else want to come in? Okay, so I'll take Lynn as the last comment. So Samad.
I'm sorry.
So I think at a general level, we should probably, instead of just talking about non-ASCII characters, just talk about technical side of Whois and whether there are any limitations in that, in the context of again those two goals that we have to promote consumer trust, and so there may be other issues, technical issues, in addition to non-ASCII. So there should be a more generic placeholder, and then we can come and look at some of the other things if there is need.
Thank you. So perhaps, Samad, if we put at the beginning of that line, we put technical issues, e.g. non-ASCII character sets, right. So that we know that that's just an example of it, but it's not the whole story. Lynn?
In our previous meetings, I mean, just on this list of gaps, we talked about the contracts are not the same depending on when the contract was put in place and when it comes up for renewal. So to me, the gap is a lack of consistency in all the contracts. And you know, there's an explanation for it, but it's still a lack of consistency.
And so a quick recommendation attached to that would be to have policy pulled into a separate document that the contracts, regardless of when they are signed, point to. That's a way to harmonize the policy even when your contracts are different dates.
Sort of object-orientated approach to contracting, perhaps. So that brings us to just after 3 o'clock, and that was the point where we all agreed we would move on from this. Can I say thank you very much for engaging with this? I know that the amount of sleep around this table can probably be calculated in minutes rather than hours in the last 24 hours. So thank you very much, and thank you, Alice and Olof, for scribing that very well. I think that this has given us a very healthy start to our draft outline, and it means that in starting to flesh out the sections now, whoever takes that forward, and I think we'll probably split that up amongst the team, will have a good idea of what we as a group all think are the issues in each heading. So thank you and well done. Now this is the moment where we go to the implementation sub-team to take us through the inventory of Whois compliance as it is. I think I sent that to you, Alice, didn't I? Members of the implementation sub-team, Peter, perhaps you'd like to take us through the presentation, or would you like me? Would you like me to do it?
You're doing such a good job, Emily.
Fine. If everybody's comfortable, I'm sure Bill and Michael will jump in at relevant points. I don't know whether this is visible to, because it's sort of pale blue and white on pale blue. Isn't it pretty? Okay. It's peaceful. It's neutrally branded, recognising that this is just a sub-team's work. So, very similar to the work that James and Kathy did prior to San Francisco, we have gone through the materials available to us. I think that, a bit like the policy work, what we found was, I'm sure what we're presenting here is not the full picture, but it's as good as we have at the moment, if I can put it like that. So what we're going to try and do is link back to the contracts, which very much sort of passes the baton, and then look at the what was on the website and what we know about the compliance team's activity. I'm sure this will be fleshed out more as we learn more from the compliance team. And then just to have an idea of what the different stakeholders reported so far on issues of compliance. So the link between the contracts and the compliance, this is a recap, really, of what was in the registrar accreditation agreement that James took us through last time. The requirements are for public access to WHOIS data, to secure the registrant's consent to the terms of registration, in fact, sort of putting the ball in the registrant's court about maintaining and providing accurate data, and actually the domain name can be cancelled for failure on the registrant's part to comply with this. The registrar is also obliged under the contract to take reasonable steps to investigate inaccuracies when they're brought to their attention. Then looking at the registries, oh, I think Michael's slide on this isn't included. I'm sorry. Oh, okay. Take us through it.
I managed to look through the registry agreements with 18 GTLDs, which are currently having such agreements with ICANN. And I can just put this slide,
yes,
if
yes,
or to send it to Alice. So I'm not sure that it's...
Yeah, I think you have the same problem.
There's myself.
To Alice and then this is my poor document control, because actually Michael sent me this slide and I failed to put it in.
Excuse me, just it will take 1 minute.
So the way that we divided the labour was Michael got the Michael was volunteered to do going through all of the registry agreements, and you said that there are 18 in place, which and to see whether there are standard obligations right across and to highlight any differences between them.
Well, I will I would say that there are not substantial differences between different agreements. However, what I was a little bit surprised, there is no unified terminology. So in different agreements, same things and same actors, they are called differently, so there is a variation. However, it's clear what is meant, fortunately. Yes. Yeah. The information on WHOIS is concentrated in section 3.1 of each agreement, which says about data escrow as a mechanism how this data escrow or mirror site policy should be arranged by the registry. And there is also a ref. Have you received it, Alice? No, not yet. And also there is a reference to the appendices to the agreements, which describe the requirements, what should be in such WHOIS data. As for the appendices, there are at least four of them. Some agreements have a very detailed description, yes. And some agreements which are, seem to be older, there are no such, maybe not such details. But in general, there is Appendix 4, which says about the report container and the technical requirements to this escrow container. The most detailed information is in Appendix 5, which is called HOI specification, and it's exactly how it is implemented and what is mentioned there. There is a reference to the RFC 954. There is a description of HOI service data elements. The full list of HOI's output fields, the specification of HOI's provider data, including procedures and formats, and the section which is called HOI's data specification ICANN, which also says about the formats that are interchangeable or exchangeable between the provider and ICANN. There are also certain information in Appendix 7 and the Part 6 of Appendix S, which relates with the service requirements, performance specifications, etc. And it's mostly about the interruptions of services, the service availability. So it's a fairly extensive technical information, which has a lot of fields. And just very briefly, it's like that. So I think that most of the people have already seen this. So I would say that in most of the agreements, the information is the same, with the slight differences for the terminology.
Thank you very much, Michael. Michael, based on what you've researched here, it makes me wonder all over again how thin WHOIS information is permitted for registries. It sounds like in the registry contracts that would not be permitted. Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but it sounds to me like their contract is requiring a thick WHOIS, and that's not what they've actually implemented, most of them.
I think the thin WHOIS is...
Did you say most registries are... Yeah, there's just ComNet and, I believe, jobs. But...
You further.
Yeah. And that... that particular contract, I think, may predate ICANN. Yeah. So.
Okay. But, yeah, I guess I'm just saying I'd like to get a better understanding of the thin WHOIS and who is permitted to have thin WHOIS and why. Yeah.
Okay, so sort of just summarizing the contractual obligations for both registrars and registries, there are two key concepts which are also found in the AOC as well, the concept of availability and accuracy of WHOIS data. So this is our first stab at inventory of compliance activity. I think that the way I looked at this was to look at what if a member of the public wanted to find out what's being done about WHOIS, they might start at the ICANN website and look for the compliance pages and look at what the compliance teams say they are doing. So there was something that was very interesting, which is an 8-stage operating plan, and I'm not quite sure when this dates from. But it actually brings up a lot of the issues that we were talking about earlier today, about fostering a culture of compliance, and I think that the difference between compliance as a sort of proactive, consensual thing rather than enforcement, which is more of a top-down hammer blow, is quite interesting here. So it's the idea of working in partnership with the registries and registrars to do this. Proactiveness, resolving matters informally, I think this is a point that that you raised here about, and also timeliness, which again came up in our gap analysis. And moving on to the next principles. Sorry? Just chime in.
I didn't know what is. Are we asking questions? Or?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, can we go back one slide?
Yeah.
I've just realised by looking at the next slide that I haven't put down all eight principles. I've just highlighted some of them.
Your favourite principles, not all eight principles. I got it.
Okay.
And after all that, I lost the handle on what I was going to... No, I think this is important, and I think that there's a... I hope it's maybe... I'm not catching it correctly, but we want to make sure there's not a misconception on this group that ICANN compliance... versus an enforcement group, it is a culture where I think that they want to work constructively with contracted parties. Of course, I would prefer they work constructively with me and crack the whip over everybody else, but that's just how it goes. But I think that it boils down to complying with existing policy is expensive and resource intensive. So those folks who are doing the right things and are being the good actors want to. Preserve that investment by working constructively with compliance, whereas the folks who are cutting corners, skipping that, probably need a healthier dose of enforcement. Thanks.
So I think the general comments on the website was it's good that there is an operating plan, and there's quite extensive reports of activities. There's published studies on data accuracy, on privacy and proxy, which highlight what's being done. I think there are a number of areas for improvement. Just to highlight, there was a spate of monthly newsletters, I think, in 2008, and then they've dwindled to once a year, and then nothing since 2009. Again, there are semi-annual reports, which it may be that these have been done and they're just not on the website. The semi-annual reports, again, kind of dwindle and haven't been updated recently that I could see. Generally, as a general point, and this comes to your point, Lynn, about communication, locating information is very, very difficult. Very, very, very difficult. And I have a sense that key documents might well exist but are not there. And I think that this is evidence of a team that's maybe under-resourced or overstretched, and that the communication, the simple things like updating the website with what you're doing, are the last thing, the first thing to go, and actually the last thing you think about when you're firefighting. That's my speculation. Next slide. Well, what we do have, as I said earlier, is we have the report on data accuracy and a study on proxy and privacy, which I think is relevant to our activities given our discussion paper. So the findings of this study was that proxy and privacy are used between 15 and 25% of records. That's not a sort of blurry amount. It actually all depends on how you define it. Because whilst there are well-known and very popular privacy or proxy services offered by some of the larger registrars, then there are other records which the study found are effectively a proxy or a privacy. They're just sort of not particularly official in that way. Something that we might want to look at is their definitions and the differentiation that they make between a proxy service and a privacy service. Privacy being, I think, where they name the registrant accurately, but the other details are suppressed, and proxy where somebody else entirely stands in the place of the registrant for all the records. They didn't look at costs or the differentiation of services out there. Good points are that it was an evidence-based approach, and I think that it came back to our conversations earlier about what is going to assist in a proactive enforcement or compliance regime is knowing what's out there. Just having the basic evidence is useful, and that it's just a very straightforward, simply defined, simple parameters. It doesn't sprawl all over the place. It just does what it says on the tin. I managed to find this report by following a link in the compliance team's presentation to us in London, but there was no way that I could find it on the website without that link. So I think that's an easy area to improve on. And I think, as so what? I was left with a feeling of, well, and? You know, and which I think is a very important question for us to ask ourselves when we're thinking about the effectiveness of compliance, is what is better as a result of the compliance intervention? What is better as a result of our implementation? Next, there's a study last year of WHOIS accuracy, which we discussed in some detail on some of our calls. And these findings are actually taken from we highlighted those in our discussion paper, so that I think they're familiar to us. Again, it sort of notes that proxy privacy are used by a substantial number of registrants in some way. I think they actually looked back at they're using similar figures to that. So I think they've used that study to inform their work. And then the next slide. So I think that when we're looking at what can be done on data accuracy, there were some quite useful pointers, I thought, in this study. Like, the most common error was tardiness in keeping data updated because of change of address. Now, that's, on one level, not criminal, not suspect. It's the sort of easy mistake that everybody makes. But just tackling that or having a program to tackle that could really make an impact and help. It also noted, Peter was talking about incentivizing good behavior, punishing bad behavior. What are the incentives for registrants to keep the data accurate? There's a sense that there's no adverse consequences of failure. But actually, if we think back, and here we go to our gaps, if we think back to the contract, it's a very, very clear obligation on the registrant to keep that data up to date and accurate on pain of losing their domain name. So there's a very clear disincentive and adverse consequence of failure. So why are they not perceiving that? Query, is it being done? Now, a barrier to accuracy, which we heard a lot about from the compliance team, so this is obviously figuring very large in their sense of what tools are not available to them, was no proof of identity, no requirement for the name of your domain name to be your full legal name, for it to be your registered address, for it to be... They used an example of somebody had put... their registrant address as the name of the person whose computer they used to register the domain name, and that there's a lot of examples of that. And also the respondent confusion. Now, it took me a long time to find relevant information looking at the ICANN site, looking across registrar sites about how to find terms of use, what terms, you know, so it's not surprising I would suggest to us all that respondents, registrants sometimes find it confusing to know what's required of them. Communication. And this other element that we just picked up in our discussion just now about script translation problems leading to apparent inaccuracies in WHOIS data. So the good points are a nice evidence-based study. Now, I know from our discussions when we talked about this study that you know, it's not been welcomed with open arms by everybody. People have issues with certain categorizations or the way things were done, but it is there. It does provide some quantifiable basis for moving forward. It provides a baseline so that you can say, well, in 2010 the situation was this, and now, using the same inevitably imperfect parameters, the situation is this plus 10% better. What I was looking for, now we've got this, I think it was done at the end of last year or maybe in the middle of last year, I couldn't find ICANN compliance team's response to that, what they're going to do as a result, and maybe this will come through in our discussions later on. Where's the plan to demonstrate improvements over time? What follow-up measures have been implemented? How are you going to prove that because of your existence, the world is better, the world of WHOIS and data accuracy is better as a result of what this study told us? So we've paid for this study. what do we learn, what's our plan? I wasn't sure of that.
Just a question. Was this study meant, was the purpose of this study meant to inform compliance, or I'm not sure that it was. I thought that these studies were, I'm genuinely asking because I don't remember, but I thought these were kicked off by the GNSO to inform policy development. So maybe in here for areas of improvements, instead of what is ICANN's compliance response, we shouldn't presume that this was aimed at them and ask who at ICANN, is receiving this and what are they doing about it?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, I made an assumption because the compliance team highlighted it as a relevant study and highlighted on their site as a relevant study, that therefore there was some sort of follow-up, but good point, maybe not. In which case, I do ask myself, what's it there for?
To follow your point, Emily, if it was put on their website, and also on their website is their plan, 8-point plan, which it talks about being proactive and so on. So there's a study that says, quarter of the records are inaccurate. If the compliance team is being proactive, arguably I would be with you, Emily, assuming that there would be a plan to improve that situation.
I guess the recollection I have or the impression I have is that this study about accuracy was triggered by complaints from both the intellectual property constituency and the business constituency about domain name abuse. And so there were so many complaints and so much discussion about it that the study was initiated. That Denise is nodding her head. I mean, that's my impression of what instigated it.
I wouldn't make an assumption that this was done for the compliance office and there was an intended specific follow up for compliance. But over the years, there had been discussion and lots of questions raised about privacy and proxy services, and that is why ICANN launched this sort of initial survey assessment that Stacy had referred to in her report. And we can talk more about. And so it was the intention was to inform the discussion, both inside ICANN and I think within the GNSO. Yeah. Does that help?
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think that's correct. And Denise, wasn't this and the other studies proposed as kind of a way, in the wake of the collapse of the OPOC idea or proposal, there was a discussion about how the whole mechanism of WHOIS discussion had just hit a wall, and that there were I think I remember almost 100 different hypotheses that were presented for studies, WHOIS studies, and there was a group put together that I was on that was kind of trying to call these and categorize these and prioritize these into something manageable. So I guess that's how I remember this coming about, and it was a pretty large group of the community that was really trying in good faith to break the logjam on these issues after OPOC died on the table and try to get something going and inform the policy folks. So that's why I was going. I don't think it was put the ball in the compliance folks.
If I could just... I was aware that the impetus for creating some of these studies did perhaps not come from the compliance team. However, the point I'm trying to raise here is the studies exist. They highlight some areas where the situation can be improved. And so it begs the question of what the response is, not actually meaning that in a kind of getting at any one way, but just would like to know. Bill.
I note that, in the current year, fiscal year, and the coming fiscal year, ICANN, the community, will be spending a fair amount of money on who is studies. I know that we've done it in the past, and my look at this is saying, okay, great, we did studies, now what have we done with them? And one of the interventions I've made, I think, a couple of times at the ICANN meetings is, why are we doing more? We're spending a lot of money doing studies, and what has been the impact of the studies that we have done? What is the result? If it isn't, and again, this is not, to Emily's point, this is not to point fingers or do anything, but hopefully the result of a study, right, is that some action is taken, from my perspective, and the action shouldn't be, let's go do another study. Right? It's, we should learn something from the study, either as a community, as a staff, as a corporation, we decide to do something. Unless we've determined that the study was, completely faulty, in which case, shame on us for putting out an RFP, right, that didn't get us a result that we wanted.
Okay. Olaf, and then Lynn.
Just to highlight that there is an ongoing policy work within the GNSO on registration abuse policies. So it is most certainly one of the background papers for that one.
I think that when we consider consumers, that a typical consumer who wants to find out who the owner of a website is, they're not even probably going to use the term domain name. They're going to go to a search engine, and they're going to put in that phrase, like website owner or URL owner. And even if you put in the term who is, like if you go to search engines, they're not going to know typically who ICANN is. And if you go to search engines and put in those phrases, you just get all kinds of things. And you will get responses that list all kinds of Whois services, all kinds of domain name companies. So again, like looking at the consumer trust aspect, I think we need to recognize that and capture it somehow in our report.
I think that comes back to the ease of use theme that we've highlighted as you know, and also communication about the policy.
Yeah, but it is the implementation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So can we move on to the next slide, please, Alice? One of the things that the compliance team told us about in their report to us in January was the Whois Access audit report, which at that time was ongoing and has now been published, I think. So this is about access. Do you remember our two key terms, access? This is availability of Whois services rather than accuracy. So they found that there was a 99% compliance rate via port 43, which is very good. Then there were basically 11 registrars who weren't really doing things right. And going back to the operational plan, 10 of those were resolved through dialogue, just helping the registrar to comply, sorting it all out. And one registrar who didn't comply was terminated. So I think that this is a very successful compliance intervention. Limited parameters, limited scope, we know what we're talking about. Very much evidencing working constructively with registrars and fostering this compliancy culture. And effective intervention, things changed as a result that, going from, this is perhaps on the polishing a shiny bit type of thing, that you're dealing with a very, very high compliance rate to start with, but as a result of the intervention, things got better. Communication, why did I have to search so hard to find this successful piece of compliance? Because this is a very good story.
in my view, in a number of ways. And I think that, that as with any intervention, it's always a challenge then to sustain the momentum and to make sure that the compliance rate doesn't drop off. And also, how can we measure this over time to track our performance in ways that are meaningful as a snapshot? Then, I must say I struggled here with the acronyms because they're like almost identical, but they mean completely different things. So this is about reporting a problem with data in Whois that we found out about in London. So this is what I managed to find out. There was a drop-off in reports received, and I think this came through in the compliance team's presentation to us. But ICANN has developed a multiple choice feedback form for registrars so that they can tell ICANN what happened as a result of the report. Okay. I don't know, and I hope that we can get this information. So what happens to that information? You've got a gold mine of information here where it looks like a very well-designed form here. You should be getting all of the information that you need to know about what the registrar did with the data problem report. But I was struggling to find how does data accuracy improve as a result of this entire system. So apart from termination, what other compliance steps have been taken as a result of this system? These are my questions. This is the nearly identical but different policy. Registrars have to send a notice every year to every registrant. And so, James, how many notices is that for GoDaddy?
Per registrant or per registration? Millions.
Millions. Millions. Yeah. Millions. And you do this per
enough to get on a number of
blacklists.
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you.
So there's a cost, would you say?
A significant cost.
A significant cost, both in, you know, just doing it and what and grief. So the 2009 reports. I think there were 6 annual reports on this compliance. 93% of registrars participate, and 99% of that data set do it right. That's good, isn't it? Okay, so that means that 93% of registrars send annual notices to their registrants, reminding them of their duties to keep their data up to date and accurate. Okay? And most of them do that right. So but unfortunately, 83% of those who responded said that they could not track the changes resulting from these notices. So we have no idea whether or not this is effective in improving data accuracy. No one's measuring that.
I also have a question. This is obviously a consensus ICANN policy. So there will be a requirement in the RAA for compliance with this. 7% of registrars aren't doing it. Like 93% are, 7% aren't doing it. I'm interested to know what happens as a result of them not doing it.
They may not have active registrations.
But they're not sending out reminder notices at all?
They don't have active registrations.
Oh, they don't have registrations.
I don't know. I'm speculating. That's one possibility, for example. Or they could be a single entity registrar that is managing for just, a portfolio holder, like you'd mentioned earlier. So,
okay.
There are possibilities, but I would leave it to compliance to figure out.
Yeah.
You know.
Be an interesting question.
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we sure jumped through that hoop.
I just had a quick question about the percentage. How many of the domain names do those 83 respondents actually represent?
Well, you could have 83%
of responding registrars said they couldn't track the changes, but if those 83% actually manage 5% of the entire domain, then really it doesn't matter as long as you're getting most people.
Yeah, I had the similar question about the 7% that didn't participate. How many, you know, what's the count that represents?
I guess I just wanted to make a comment, which was there appears to be a lot of work going on. There's a lot of data. There are a lot of statistics. And we don't seem to know much as a result.
I think that that's what struck me going through this, was that there's a significant investment in this WDRP going on many actors' parts. But at the end of the day, if we cannot tell what happened as a result, that's a problem.
The other thing I wanted to compliment Emily on, being able to get the acronyms for these two things correct as best I can tell. I spent the better part of an hour seriously on the ICANN website trying to figure out which was which and what it meant. So I actually think that should be a gap that we list, as these policies are too confusing, the names of them.
I think this is the section where that sort of brings to an end what we managed to find, or what I managed to find out about the compliance activities. I'm sure there's more. We have, of course, I went through the compliance team's presentation to us in January to make sure that I was picking up the things that they were highlighting. So I hope I haven't missed things. Bill, please.
Yeah, I mean, I want to be clear. I was being facetious a bit, but there is an incredible amount of work being done.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm.
And then, sadly, I don't think we're getting much for it. That's my impression. I don't know if there's data to back that up, but I haven't detected a significant improvement in WHOIS accuracy over time. Yet we're doing more and more to supposedly address the problem.
Look, I just wanted to agree with Bill. This presentation has really highlighted that. We don't have to do it now. I think all the placeholders are there in our gap analysis, but because we've got sort of brief references to accuracy and so on, but I think we can sharpen some of those up when we revisit them in light of this. There seems to be a theme here that, as Bill has highlighted, there's a lot of potentially a lot of work going on. There's registrars mailing out millions of emails and, you know, doing a lot of work. We're not sure what it means, and there is still a high level of inaccuracy. So in terms of our gap analysis, I think this will be really, really helpful. Yeah.
I think that's right. And so that's the kind of informational bit about activities that I could pick up. And then we've talked to a number of people. We had a very good session in London with the compliance team, and they were very open with us. We've also had informal chats with them, and also talked about compliance with a number of the stakeholders that we've spoken to, most recently the IPC. I thought that was an extremely helpful conversation. So this is just trying to summarise the feedback that we've had so far. Thank you. The big message I got from the compliance team, I think, was resources. Filling open positions, and this is taken from the presentation that they gave us, making the necessary and operational and structural changes that they see as a prerequisite of being effective. And also, you know, how on earth do you effectively manage 1,000 relationships with 5 full-time equivalents and 1 temp? Now, obviously, some of those relationships are going to be more labour-intensive than others. there's a long tail in ICANN as there is in any domain name registration kind of world. But James, did you
I would just
in?
Point out that not all of those registrar entities, accredited registrars, are active, and in fact there may be less than a couple of hundred active registrars.
Then why do we maintain them? Why does ICANN maintain them if they are inactive?
They're registrars in good standing. They just are not actively registering or managing domain names.
If I'm ICANN, the corporation, why do I want to maintain a relationship with people who aren't bringing any business? That's the question I'm asking.
Because they've paid their fees, they meet their requirements, they haven't broken any rules, they're just not doing anything.
They're like your ideal customer, aren't they? They pay their dues and don't demand any resources.
No,
this is something else, yeah.
If I'm an inactive registrar, why would I choose? I don't know what the fees are to maintain myself as a registrar, but why would I pay these fees?
Maybe we can chat about that later, I think, just in the interest of time. It's a
okay,
good point.
I'm happy to take it offline. I would do want to, in addition to this, right, the last... I think it's the WDRPS, but I'm not sure. It's the one where you can say, I think there's a problem with the data. So I want to submit it to ICANN, who's then going to forward it on to, I believe, a registrar. The latest report I could find on that was showing data on the order of 3,000 hits a month. Okay, and if the compliance team, and it's my understanding the compliance team is responsible for those as well, in addition to having 1,000 registrars, 17 registries, they also have 3,000 or 36,000 roughly per year, data problems or data reporting problems, whatever it is, coming in. I just don't know how they can, how they possibly can maintain a reasonable level of quality on that.
So I've got Sarmad and James, or do you want to just come in on that?
So my original point in bringing up the 1,000 is please don't necessarily fall for the there's only 5 of us and we have thousands of registrars to watch. There's only a few hundred that are active, number one. And number two, the answer is automation. And we live in a, how do we easily 3,000 to 4,000 employees manage millions and millions of registrations and customers? And the answer is automation.
Yes, I would agree.
So I have a question, which is how does ICANN or registrars verify the correctness of this data if it's reported as being faulty? And second thing is... just looking ahead, there's a disaster looming, considering that there's going to be IDN data coming into this, which already highly inaccurate system, and verification process for the IDN data is going to be even more complex.
My answer to your question, Sarmad, is I don't know how. And one of the things that I think was, as far as I can see, one of the things that was highlighted by the study on data problem reporting is that there is no follow-up that people are comfortable is accurate, if you see what I mean. So that while the registrars are asked very, very good questions, like the questions that you would think, yeah, that's exactly what we want to know about what they did, including nothing, the registrars are saying, we don't know what happened as a result.
So I think what I'm leading to is should data, who is data verification process be part of a policy?
I'm just wondering what is meant by verification there. I know this is a potentially contentious and difficult issue which is being dealt with in a couple of forums. I'm just wondering what's meant by verification there, just for...
Let me just explain that a bit more. So what I'm saying is that the contract says between ICANN and the registrar that you are going to maintain accurate data, and if the data is not accurate, you can cancel or you should cancel a registration. But it doesn't really specify how to actually gauge the correctness of the data. So is that left to the interpretation of the registrar, or what's the criteria for correctness?
That's a very, very good question. James may have some more insights even than me, but this is an issue that I believe is under discussion between registrars and law enforcement.
It's a much larger question.
Yeah.
I think that... that's weird. I'm very electric, apparently. That verification... Okay, I'm going to step back just a bit here. The RAA doesn't necessarily say that. Okay. What it says is effectively that the registrant is responsible for making their data accurate, and I think that the previous policies that we've gone through here make that very clear, that the burden of accuracy is on the registrant. Now, it does say that the registrar must take action when something is brought to their attention, and that they have reason to believe that the information is incomplete, inaccurate, etc. And that's why we have the problem reporting system. Now. How do we do that? Is an excellent question, and there is fuzzy logic involved. We do have some automated systems that will check. I don't want to go too deeply now into our internal processes, but we have some automated systems that run some checks, and then we have systems that will flag human review as well. But there are certainly some areas of this planet where Bob's house... is a legitimate address. Small islands, for example, we'll say, or very small communities or rural areas. So, you have to use some judgment. We try to give the benefit of the doubt to an individual who looks like they are making an attempt to give a contactable or serviceable address or contact information. We try to err on the side of caution. I know that there are some who want to say, especially, and I should mention, domain investors who will use this system to try to shake the trees and see if they can get someone to cough up a valuable name by not responding. They want to see ST period as an inaccurate representation for street. Okay, so I mean, and everything in between. This is not a this is a very challenging subject, and I think that we're very cautious to not take away the names for someone that we believe is trying to use the WHOIS system in good faith.
Just as we've got 5 more minutes left, and I think there's still several slides, should we just whip through the rest of the slides and then take some questions, because we've got the rest of our meetings this week to cover as well. So ICANN told us that the challenges that they're facing are about closing the loop to create effective action, and I think that that's some of the stuff that we've been highlighting to each other. There's a problem, then there's having a system to deal with it, and then there's actually making some sort of impact or being able to know that you've made some impact if things got better and being able to say, that was because of us. I got very clearly from the compliance team that they see the silver bullet as being data authentication on the way in, and that they felt that the community didn't understand their role, scope of registrars' obligations and communications adequately, which brings us down to communication once again. So sort of you can't really manage expectations until they're communicated and they're realistic.
and people really understand what can and can't be done by ICANN and by the other people in the supply chain. Okay, the IPC gave us a lot of feedback, but the one thing that I took, you know, there was more than one person said, if you read the contracts in isolation, they ought to work, but in practice it doesn't happen. And so that really highlights the gap that I think that we've been hovering around, saying, well, the policy kind of more or less there, or if you live with the policy, it should be delivering a different reality to what we have. There seemed to be an understanding from the IPC that there's a genuine need or a legitimate need for proxy and privacy services in some cases, and that with good players, there's a process for getting the data out, which kind of works. You'd want it to be there all right away, but if you can get it, well, that's fine. But that there are some registrars, are the people... We've talked about bad actors, meaning not that they're evil, but that they are people who are not in compliance on a particular point, that they never respond, and there seems to be a sense, as a result, unfairly, that nobody is enforcing the contracts. Because clearly there are people enforcing the contracts, and we can see from other areas that they do enforce in some areas. But it's kind of the damage that's done to reputation because of, you know, big problems that are perceived not to be dealt with, and a frustration at a perceived lack of resources, which may or may not be accurate, but we can certainly say that the frustration is there. They also seem to be supportive of progressive remedies, encouraging good practices, thinking about incentives, the compliance end of the spectrum rather than the enforcement end of the spectrum, and recognising that sometimes it's not evil, it's just inexperience or, you know, not being, you know, not having your business quite sorted out, that's the primary reason for non-compliance. And next slide. So registries and registrars we're going to meet with this week. That's primarily a sort of a working meeting for the implementation sub-team, but those who are interested would be very welcome to join. We've developed some questions which we've circulated to the whole review team, and obviously we'll be feeding back to you on Wednesday and beyond. And then I think that might be it. Yes, there we go. Whistle stop talk. Any questions that we haven't already picked up? Comments? What next? Thank you. So I think that just gives us a starting point. I'm obviously looking forward to following up with the compliance team and making sure that we have actually captured what they're doing fairly. That's based on their presentation to us, what we could find on the website and other staff, but obviously we'll be going back to them. We're meeting with them today as well after this meeting. So are we tired? Do we have... Now, I'm nervous about saying a 5-minute break, because then we all wander in half an hour later. So should we just push through until 4:45 or so? Or are people desperate for a break?
What's next?
Next on the agenda is thinking about this week and our schedule of meetings with stakeholders. And perhaps we can just do it by taking each one in turn, trying to remember what they told us last time if we met them, what we want out of them, and relevant points from our discussion paper that we should be taking them to. Raring to go? Come on, we're nearly there.
Bearing in mind... we agreed that our purpose is to evaluate the effectiveness of the current policy, and this morning we looked at clear, it's going to be clear, enforced and communicated. And then we've identified quite an extensive list of stakeholders. Have all of our questionnaires and our engagement covered that whole list of stakeholders, or if there are any that haven't been in the list, do we need to an action plan around that?
Well, just to what we've done is within the ICANN world, you've got pretty much all of the stakeholders roughly represented here. That doesn't mean that by talking to them you've talked to everybody, but we've made efforts to reach out to all of the ICANN communities, and both here and in San Francisco we got around quite a few of them. The other aspect of this goes to the consumer study that we want to do. So the two big gaps are law enforcement, which isn't, you know, it doesn't have a bespoke unit within ICANN to, and that's why we're doing what we're doing through you and through the GAC with Peter, and also consumer, some consumer research, because we've recognised that there's a large number of stakeholders who may well rely on this information but might not be aware or certainly don't participate in ICANN, and so that's the reasoning behind that. Okay, so does anybody need a quick crash course in what these various communities do? Sharon? Yeah. Okay. And actually, we've got representatives from some of these communities here, so if I stumble, then please help me out. On Tuesday, we have got no less than 5 meetings. The first is with the Security and Stability Advisory Committee, SSAC. Samad, you're their representative here, aren't you? So they're more looking at stability and security. They were talking to us very much at the protocol level, and making a distinction between the WHOIS service, which is, I think, what we're often talking about, and the protocols that underlie it. But Samad, yeah, can you also talk about what we would like from them this time and what you think they told us last time?
Okay, so just to summarize what they were talking about last time was that there was just one concrete feedback on that in our report and in our proceedings we should consistently use correct terminology, and not just correct but unambiguous terminology, and we need to differentiate between who is data, who is service, who is protocol. Yes, thank you. And not refer to these things as generically as who is. We should be careful and be very specific whenever we use who is to specify which particular aspect of who is we're referring to. So I think that was probably the only single comment last time around WHOIS interaction.
And thinking about the paper that we've just published, what particular aspects do you think the SSAC will be, you know, what would we want their input on, and what do you think they'll want to give us input on? If the answer's nothing, then that can be the answer.
Can I request to come back to you on that? Yes.
The next constituency is the non-commercial users constituency. Now, my recollection is that this is part of the GNSO help. The NCUC is part of the GNSO, is it?
Yes.
It is. Oh. Anyone from the non-commercial users constituency?
Yeah, wear funny hats and they'll be happy. No, I mean, it's as the name says, I mean, it's represents the non-commercial group within ICANN, and I think they're probably going to have input on everything, but their main issues might be stakeholders and the definition of consumer trust.
Thank you. business constituency. Susan. So the commercial stakeholder group too.
Sorry, Len, I just jumped in. So that would be the IPC and the BC. The difference there's not a whole lot of difference, but in my opinion, the business constituency is more business-oriented. The intellectual property constituency is pretty much intellectual property attorneys. But it's the same issues that they are concerned with, and also it should include the ISPC, and actually I don't have much exposure to that group. Do you, Lynn, at all?
No. Internet service providers?
Yes.
Yeah. Internet service providers.
That's distinct from registrars, is it?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hosting the companies.
Large internet service providers.
Right.
Hosting companies. A rather small constituency in terms of who's actually involved in
that. Right. Okay. So, Lynn, if you were thinking about what feedback they would be giving us, now remember we had the call with the IPC recently, mm-hmm. What particular aspects of the issues paper do you think that people in that group will be wanting to give us feedback on, and what would we be looking for from them?
I think it'll be similar information or, you know, concerns as the IPC call. And though in the BC there's definitely a contingent that is not necessarily so intellectual property focused, and definitely do not want to see that taken too far, put it that way. So
So do you think that they'll be looking at our compliance questions more, or our policy questions more, do you think, or just everything? Do you think they'll
probably
want to talk about everything?
Mm-hmm.
Although I'm not their representative, I'm a member of that constituency, and one of the points that they may bring up, because I've heard discussion on it, is that while we generally think of proxy services for individuals, in the business community, proxy services are used, you know, when they're planning to introduce a new product or in mergers and acquisitions, and you have like a name, a new company name or something that you're not ready to announce publicly. So typically proxy services are not used to keep something confidential indefinitely, but you know, for a period of time. So I would expect them to possibly make that point. And similar to intellectual property, you know, domain abuse is a big concern. And there are some members of the business constituency, particularly Verizon, AT&T, and Susan, you may know some of the other companies, but I know they've had just extensive work with domain abuse. So how that might prompt them to respond to our discussion paper, I mean, there could be, you know, a variety of things there. I think the dispute process is something they're all very familiar with. So everybody in that constituency understands how that works. On the non-commercial, if I could jump back for a minute, is that different from this new group that's being formed, the nonprofit? I think it's called NPOC. How is it, you know, forgive me, but what's the difference?
I think Denise knows.
So the GNSO restructured a year or so ago and organized into a couple of broad stakeholder groups intended to be umbrella groups for more specific focused constituencies. So the commercial stakeholder group includes the ISPs, the intellectual property interests, and the business interests. There's also a non-commercial stakeholder group intended to be an umbrella group for more focused constituencies like a non-commercial organizational constituency. There's a proposal for a consumer organization constituency and a proposal for a non-profit organization constituency. So does that make sense? We've got, and you're meeting with one of the constituencies within the umbrella group.
I think the Red Cross is in the new one. Is it Barbara Hughes?
Deborah
Hughes with the Red Cross? Okay.
So I believe you're meeting with one constituency within the stakeholder group. You're,
The next one is registries. That's Kathy's constituency. I would expect, I don't know, James, would you want to speculate what they might want to talk about with us?
No. I think it registries and registrars are, they collectively are the contracted party's house, and they are, as you might imagine, they're commercial entities that are sensitive to changes in their contracts, but want to make sure that the playing field, the competitive playing field, is fairly, is fair and policed properly and equitably. So I think that's probably a generic enough statement for both sides of the contract party house.
Bill?
Yeah, I was, when I first saw the calendar invites, I was somewhat confused because we are meeting, it appears, separately with the registries group and then jointly with the registries and the registrars group. And I'm trying to understand why we're doing both. Why?
I think I can help with that. We met with the registrars group in San Francisco, and we were actually going to meet with the registries then as an entire review team to talk about the whole study. The registries and registrars mixed group is a small group intended for the implementation sub-team, but obviously, come along if you'd like to. So that's more of a, that's part of the implementation sub-team's research into that very specific question of compliance. So the one on Tuesday is much more at the high level, looking at the entire issues paper. And the one on Wednesday will be a bit more kind of a working workshop type of session. I hope that we'll get a bit more into the detail on compliance itself. ALAC, does anybody want to take the at-large committee? Is it advisory committee? Okay. At-large? Anyone?
Yes, sir.
As it happens, my name is Carlton Samuels. I'm on the at-large. I'm from the at-large and on ALAC. The ALAC, as you probably know, is the conduit from the at-large community to the ICANN board. Essentially, it's an advisory committee. Its role is to provide advice to the board, and it's really set as a kind of a consolidator or a funnel for the at-large voice. So that is the individual internet user. And that's what we tend to define our constituency as, individual internet users. You might know with respect to the who is, and we had a policy meeting this morning. There are various several strands of who is of interest to the at large. There are some of our members who are very much concerned about who is, and as it bumps up against the privacy issue. There are members who are concerned about who is with respect to security and, of course, the security of transactions on the internet and how that might impact individual users. And there are others who are, yet again, interested in seeing the WHOIS measures ICANN's performance with respect to its the way it handles WHOIS matters with, in terms of registrar agreements and its interaction with registrar constituency. The at large does have a standing working group for WHIS, and we are trying to reach out to that working group as we speak, and because some of us believe that the charter as it now exists is way too narrow in terms of the diverse interests of the members of the at large in the matter of WHIS. You may have seen our ALAC's response to the WHIS review team, and it gives you some framework for what our interest is in this group. Just to reiterate, we think it's important to have this review. We also think it's important to address the question of whether or not the WHIS that is as it was originally constructed is still relevant to need, and if it is relevant, in what areas. If it's not relevant, what areas is it weak, and what would you, the review team recommend? And of course, we are very keen to see the issues that are embracing at large become a part of your, well, it becomes part of your working environment, which is to say the most important ones. The issue of the transaction security on the internet and the issue of privacy as that impacts individual internet users. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Carlton, for that heads up and description of what the ALAC does and its interest in who is being privacy, security of transactions, and also the measures that ICANN are taking with respect to the performance of who is. I think that for those of us who are also interested in establishing consumer trust in its that might be an area to explore with the ALAC, because here you are with individual internet users, which is going to be, as you know, an opportunity to take that perspective. We then have the GAC on Wednesday. Peter, do you want to say anything about what the GAC's expectations are, what they're likely to be interested in talking to us about, etc.?
I can't speak definitively, but I expect that the GAC will be interested to talk about ICANN's compliance activities. Certainly, the GAC has had an interest in the new GTLD program, with making some strong comments about ICANN's compliance activities, being appropriately staffed, having adequate resources, and so on. So I expect that interest will extend to this. There was obviously a GAC submission on applicable laws, ensuring that that we cast our net wide enough to cover all applicable laws. Governments are obviously interested in all their laws as they go to the trouble to make them. I think it will be... I'm not sure what else will come up, to be perfectly honest.
It might be that the GAC WHOIS principles also come up.
The GAC WHOIS principles could come up. I mean, I think we asked questions about them last... Yes, yeah, that's right. I believe so. So members may, GAC members may want to redraw the review team's attention back to the principles. I note that Kathy, one of the comments Kathy had, I'm not sure if it was just to me or was if it was to the whole review team, but the review team may want to ask the GAC if it. There are a number of potential tensions in the GAC who is principals, which are alluded to, but go no further. The review team could usefully potentially ask the GAC if it has any insights into how those tensions may play out in national legal frameworks. I mean, the one thing which we keep talking about in the review team is there is a potential conflict between WHOIS requirements and privacy law. GAC members may wish to weigh in there.
So that's a description of the different groups we're meeting this time, and some indication of their likely areas of interest. Do you have anything from the SSAC or no? Okay.
I'll actually going to consult with them and then get back to you.
I think that one thing I'd like to ask us is. First of all, I don't think I'll run through it, but we've prepared a slide deck that basically has the questions. That's it. Just who we are and the questions, so I don't think we need to labour through those. You wanted to come back, Bill?
Yeah, the last group that we have is interaction with the community.
Yeah.
I think that one may actually, depending how many people show up and what questions are or whatever, we may want to just be prepared. In essence, from a PR perspective, what are the messages we as a team want to give, and how do we stay on message?
And also, I think, out of courtesy, we've got a summary of the public comments from last time. I think out of courtesy, we should all individually remind ourselves of who submitted comments and what they said, so that when those people take the floor, we're aware of it. I think that that's probably a good thing to do. But this kind of takes us on to what we're going to be discussing. Okay, imagine now we're at our internal debriefing. It's Wednesday afternoon, evening. How are we going to capture what those individual groups said to us in a way that's useful, and what are we going to do next? Is the two things that I want us to talk about. Samad?
So may I suggest that the relevant liaisons in this committee take notes and submit a summary to this group from each of the meetings?
How does that sound? I think that sounds like a very sensible thing. We're missing a few because we don't have anyone from registries here, and we don't have anyone from ALAC here or the NCUC. But I think if we can say Peter, Susan, James, could you do the registries and registrars for us? You can do SSAC for us, and Susan. Okay, Samad's suggestion is that the liaisons from the different teams write up notes and prepare notes of the session, obviously in consultation with the groups themselves, to share with us so that there's a record. Yes. Or before. No, after, obviously. But that I think this is something that we failed to do last time, really. I think that it would be... I think that's a sensible...
Could I take it one step further and suggest that once those notes are discussed and if there is any response from WHOIS, those are again communicated back to those constituencies through the liaisons as well?
And I think that we should recognise in doing that that's a piece of work. That's something that we have to give time for in our calls, is to actually think about our response and make that response. So that's one follow-up. The people from the constituencies are going to take notes and communicate them. What are we going to do about the gaps where we don't have anybody from the constituency? Any volunteers to take notes? Yeah, you can do. What we did last time was, in fact, in reality, actually a lot of people went to a lot of them. But Kathy and I undertook to go to all of them. Obviously, I don't have Kathy here, so I would appreciate, you know, there's a recognition that everybody is here at the ICANN meeting for the most part because they have other stuff to do. And a recognition that we can't demand other than this day from people. So it's totally understood. What we said was, I will certainly go to all of them. The liaison from that specific group ought to show up. Bill, did you want to come?
Yeah, no, I will attempt, as I did last time, to attend the majority of them. There may be some that I won't be able to, but...
I think in reality people found them very useful, and they may not have intended to go to all of them, but they actually found them a good quick way to get a feel for how different sections of the world out there see this particular issue. So that's a nice bit of follow-up. I think that we can also do the same sort of pattern of verbal reporting when we have. I'd like to take the first hour of our internal debriefing to just reflect on what we found out in those meetings, and then the second hour to plan what we're going to do next. So there are various things that I know we have on the agenda that we haven't covered. Yeah. Enough, actually.
Yeah.
Why don't you do ALAC? Okay. So we've got two more that need a volunteer. NCUC. Oh, you're NCUC anyway. Sorry. I keep on thinking of you in a different constituency, and so I apologise for that. So all I've got is registries.
Yeah, no, I said
it. Oh. Is it just me then who didn't realise that we're all sorted?
My question is, will we have any staff support during any or all of this as well? So
we did have last time.
Okay, so maybe.
I think I think that's a good point, James. You know, we are all busy. A lot of us have other stuff going on. If we can ask, as we did before, and the staff gave excellent support, it's just really that liaison person is responsible for the note.
Another suggestion I would make, in addition to us doing this, is if we might send notes back to the different constituencies, let them know we are going to have somebody do that. If they could find someone to do it on their side as well in advance of the meeting, and then that we could compare notes. Because one of the issues I have had when I've been charged with taking notes and things is if I attempt to participate or understand what's going on, I forget things, and I don't write it down, and somebody else might.
So they say all the interesting bits aren't covered.
Right. Anyway, just a suggestion that if we could ask the different constituencies to maybe have somebody just taking some notes down so we can compare with what we're doing, make sure we get it covered.
I think that's a good suggestion. What I would like to do is to be completely unreliant on that happening and to cover it off from our own point of view. And obviously, if any of those constituencies want to share their notes with us, that would be brilliant.
Probably what I'll, just to share what I'll do with the GAC, is I'll take some notes, I'll circulate them to the GAC saying, did I miss anything? And once it's all cleared up, I'll recirculate. But I'll probably circulate it to the review team as well, did I miss anything? And then, yeah.
I think that's a good structure. So we just take responsibility for it and get input as we go. So, I know. Uh,
our MGM lion faces on. Now, there's one thing that I do want to cover before we finish today, and that's the status of the budget request on consumer research. And I was wondering whether anybody from staff could update us on the status of that and how that's going. Sorry, Denise or Olof, could you just update us on the budget request and how that's going?
Denise is much more up to speed on that one, so...
Yes, I don't have a whole lot to report. Emily sent the request to Peter Dengate Thrush, the chair, chairman of the board, and the board has not acted on your request. There's a straight answer yet. So as soon as they do, we'll give you an update. Reminding them periodically that this is an action item that needs attention. So we're hopeful it'll be addressed soon.
Other than just sit here and wait, is there anything usefully we can do to get things happening?
Right. So as you find yourself with board members and have an opportunity to remind them that that this is an important action that you need taken care of to move forward with your work, I think that would help too. As you can imagine, the board is extremely busy. Yeah.
So I understand that they haven't taken action. Has there been any consideration of it? The request is, and this isn't directed at you or any staff member, but this request went in some time ago. I recognize the board is busy. I have been on boards myself. I will, when I see board members, I will speak to them, but this is something we've said is an important piece of our work, and right. We cannot move forward on it.
Yeah, and just so you know, Akram Atala, our COO, is also the person responsible for marshaling this request. I'm not sure if it's been discussed yet or not. I'll find out and get back to you.
So, also not directing a pointed question at anyone personally, but I note that this was also the case with the ATRT about this time last year, where the budget was submitted and requested and was several months. So my question is this normal for the board, or is this specific to the AOC review team budgetary requests, these types of delays, or would you consider that this is true of just about any financial or budget request that has to go to the board?
No, I wouldn't make any such sweeping statement. I think in addition to this being a particularly busy period for the board, I think also the board just doesn't have a sort of automatic process in place of assigning a affirmation review team budget and resource request to a specific board committee to act on. And I think so they have a sort of process structural issue that's really separate from the substance of your request. I know that Akram anticipated additional resources being required by this team even before it was actually created. So funds were set aside in anticipation that there'd be a request and in hopes that we could meet it, expeditiously. So,
I apologize in advance. I don't know the answer to this, but just to clarify amongst ourselves, and which may be helpful if we then go to talk to board members or take this forward. In terms of timing, I haven't focused in detail about that. Once we get assuming we get some budget approval, how long will it take to, is it expected to take? We obviously need to retain someone to do this work. And then have we anticipated how long it will take to do? And therefore working back from, if Marina Del Rey is when we're drafting recommendations, we obviously need results before then, it would seem to me, and hopefully a little ways well before. How are we looking in terms of our time frame? Are we getting crunched here?
The timeline is that
just my informal polling of a few companies indicated that this type of research work can be carried out in 8 weeks from the time that a contract is signed. And then you back up from there. You know, we have to select someone to do the work and have the contract signed and negotiated, and then you back up from there, and there's the RFP, and then there's time for people to respond to the RFPs. So originally, when we submitted our request, we really needed to get that board approval, you know, within 2 to 3 weeks, and now we're, I think, at 5 weeks. So we're about 2 weeks past like our ideal timeline. Now we still would have time to get the results before November, but I originally, you know, the target was to have the actual work begin, let's say, in mid-July and finish in mid-September, so that we would have it when we get together at Marina Del Rey. And now it looks like we're probably going to miss that. So then I think we're looking at maybe Senegal, again, assuming that it's approved and that we can go forward. So what I've been doing in the meantime is building some of the information we'll need to do an RFP. And I've got a list of companies, you know, that are, you know, like a distribution list to send it to.
Thank you very much, Lynn, and I think all of us appreciate the extensive work that you've put in on this. Peter?
I guess I'm just going to say what everyone's thinking. Having just done the sums, yeah, and as you said, Lynn, like, we're not going to get the responses till after Marina Del Rey, and I'd understood that that's where we would finish drafting our report, have recommendations, so that when we're at Dakar, that's shared with the board and shared with the community, I mean, as well as with the community. So I guess at some point we need to ask a question whether this is going to work. I don't know how much we can compress these timeframes, like if the 2 months effectively for the work, getting the RFP, like how much we can compress, but at some stage, I mean, if it comes in after it's useful, I hate saying all this, but yeah, we've probably got to have some consideration of this unfortunate situation. Yeah,
right. I don't know what we can do to put pressure on getting a decision more quickly. You know, I think we've followed the appropriate protocol for submitting our request. The amount of money is significantly less than just the travel support for our own team, you know, that's been budgeted. It's not an unreasonable amount of money.
Further than that, Lynn, we've taken the advice that we've been given about the process.
Right.
We've not only done it in a timely way, we've also flagged from the very start, and as we've heard from Denise, it was anticipated that this sort of research would be needed.
Right.
So I think if, again, I can say what I think everybody is thinking, it is concern and disappointment that we might be put in a position of losing our deadlines and or missing important research into our findings because of a lack of process on the part of the board. Now, we all acknowledge that, as any board is, this board is busy, but these are review teams that are mandated by the affirmation of commitments. And for the board not to have learnt
from the similar experience of the ATRT, I think is of concern, certainly to me, and I think to others in this room.
Well, and when you submitted it, Emily, you got a very prompt acknowledgement back from Peter Dengate. I was encouraged when you got that very prompt acknowledgement, but now for so much time to go by, to your point, Peter, I think right now it's going to be pushing it, to proceed with it.
I've got a list which is Samad, Bill, and then Peter. Did you want to come in, James? No.
So should we be thinking of a plan B for what if the request doesn't come in, or there is still a possibility that it doesn't get accepted when it's presented. So what do we do? So should we discuss that at some point?
So Emily, I guess I agree with you in the strongest possible terms with respect to your comments about the board. We have followed the policy as we understand it, what we were asked to do. Just sort of back of the napkin calculations here. I think we have a minimum of 150 days to, what Lynn is saying, 60 days roughly to, on the minimum side, I think, if I heard correctly, to get an execution of the study and a report back. We would need minimum of 30 days for the, sort of the RFP to be out, for people to respond.
If I could just add into that, if we think about how long it took us to agree our issues paper, how long it might take us to agree an RFP.
Absolutely. So I was going, 30 days for us to figure out the RFP, 30 days for people to get it back, and exceedingly optimistic, 30 days for a contract to be executed, given, I believe, what we're seeing now in terms of turnaround. I don't think Peter came actually, right out and said it, but we may be at the point already that says there's no way, right? This just can't be done, even if the board approves it at this instant. I am highly suspicious that we would be able to get, if we did all of our stuff right, that we could actually get a contract executed. I'm very frustrated about this. It's not in a roughly $60-65 million budget where stuff's been allocated, anticipated, and a reasonable request comes in. It is extremely frustrating to see 30 to 50 days go by with no activity as best we can tell.
And then Denise would like to come in.
So, having just heard Bill's thing, the one thing that occurs to me is that even if the board had been quick, we might have been a bit tight on this one. But that may not be that useful. So, going to Samed's point, I guess the question is there a plan B? And I can think of, I guess, two. And I guess there's a question is, is this essential for us? Like, can we do our report without this sort of information? That's, I guess, the first threshold question. If we can't, is there another way we can get it? I guess is the next question. And if not, can we move our deadlines? These are all bad options, but I guess the question is it essential? And if it is essential, then we have to face up to some of these potentially, is there another way to get this information without a budget? Pretty tricky. Can we move deadlines? It's like that. That's as far as I can think. If there's another option, it'd be wonderful.
Thank you, James.
Oh, it's deja vu all over again. You know, I mean, listening to some of this stuff, I can't tell you how many meetings and phone calls we just were tied up just on why isn't our budget request going through? Why isn't this contract being executed? Which made me giggle a little bit, because if I recall, getting the Berkman contract executed actually took longer than the budget, if you can imagine that. So my question is, can this group proceed on the assumption that the budget will be approved? Maybe that's one way to apply some pressure. Put out the RFP now. Get a response. Get a contract in hand so that, how much of this can be parallelized as opposed to putting it in a serial sequence. I think that, I would recommend everyone go back to the final report of the Accountability and Transparency Review Team, where the chairman actually wrote a specific appendix on this issue. Then the final question would be, one recommendation, having seen this now twice, and I'm assuming that other groups are struggling with the same issues, is that these groups need a board liaison or someone perhaps that has a little bit more, influence on the board than the staff folks can give to us. I say that saying that we had the chairman on the last group, and that didn't help. But something needs to be done here. I don't know how much more influential you can get than that.
Can I give Denise the opportunity to come back? I think that, as many others have said, we recognise that that this is not a, and I hope you recognise it, all the ICANN staff, is that we're not actually having a go at you personally, that it's just that you're here and they're not. But we do want, in the strongest terms, to communicate our frustration.
So, if I may suggest, I think since we've got the board here in person, let's see if we can resolve this quickly. The board has another internal workshop on Wednesday that potentially they could address this issue. Let's see if we can make some progress with the board. Like I said, the money's already set aside, and actually we can turn around a contract very quickly. The reason the Berkman contract took as long as it did is because Berkman insisted on changes to our basic template contract. So if you choose a company that's willing to use the basic template contract, we can turn it around in 2 days. So let's also look at how we can shave perhaps some time off the schedule. You're an independent entity. You have quite a bit of flexibility in how long you leave your RFP out there and how you solicit, input. So I'd like to work with you to see how we can still make this work, and I understand also the need to perhaps explore option B. But I'd also like to help make this work for you too.
So I think we should probably put some timelines on the response of the board in the context of working on Plan B. So if, for example, if we don't hear till such date, then we need to act on it in a different way.
Why don't we revisit this on Wednesday? Let's take on board Denise's very practical advice, the fact that the board are here and so are we, and we can talk to people about it if we get a minute of their time. Let's revisit this on Wednesday and think about our response. Okay.
Just another suggestion for things we could do, which is to send a message to the board, and if other review teams are in a similar situation, ask that they go along with us and say we are basically we're going to take a hiatus until we get a response. That we've seen this with the AOC, and these teams are we're spending a lot of time. If we just counted the number of hours we each spent on airplanes to get here, okay, that's an incredible amount of time that we as volunteers have spent to do work on behalf of the organization. And it's both frustrating, but it's also disrespectful to us. Okay? And that's a message I would like to see communicated back. I don't think I want to do that individually, but I really do feel that it's disrespectful to everyone at the table, that all we have gotten back is an acknowledgement of, you know, we received your request and we will act on it at some point in time.
So, is there a way of formally communicating this back to the board, or is this a formal communication back to the board, or should we, or you, on behalf of the team, maybe send another reminder on the previous communication?
Why don't I take as an action to send a message to the board on behalf of the team?
Emily, but I was going to say, yeah, I think you're the right person to send it. Do we want to sort of take action as a group and say that this is the not only are you as the chair submitting it, but this is the unanimous view of the group, at least those present?
I would even go further than that and reach out to your counterparts on the other review teams. I don't know if they've submitted budget requests.
No,
I don't. Okay, so then.
One.
Sorry?
There's only one other team, yes. The
Security
Stability Team,
they haven't
yet.
All right, so we are alone on this one. But yes, I would say, and that, and then, right, perhaps Brian, and then perhaps to during one of the sessions that typically occurs later in the week where they have the session there, is a good time to go before the board and express this concern in addition to a formal letter.
Oh, just a quick question. Did we decide whether this is now an essential part of our report? Or because I can't remember who raised that particular question. You did. And I don't know whether we've come to a conclusion whether it is essential to our final report or whether we can actually live without it.
The actual request lays it out as being essential to the quality of our evaluation. Now, can we do an evaluation without it? Yeah. I think we can, but I don't think it'll be the same quality because it's, I think from what we described in the request, we don't have a good representation of that perspective here in the ICANN community. We just don't.
No, I understand that, but my question is, do we believe it to be so essential that we are going to that we would be willing to delay our final report to, well, next year?
Okay.
In our request, it said, right, the word required was used in terms of we are required to look afield than those who engage in ICANN. Right? That's a requirement. So we made it clear, and Peter Dengate's Thrush's response was, as Alice just forwarded to us, that they'll look at it in due course. I took that to mean expeditiously, but apparently it means something else.
We know what we feel about this issue, so I'll take an action to put together some thoughts. There is an opportunity to speak to the board later in the week, which I will take on behalf of all of us, and I'll try and circulate some thoughts in anticipation of that. I know, Sharon, we haven't really covered the law enforcement questionnaire, but I think the answer is it's out there, isn't it? Or is there anything that you wanted to
no,
add to
not,
that?
Not at all. Before Peter and I got together, and Kim and Lutz to work on the public comments and the GAC questionnaire and law enforcement, so that's just a matter of collating it all and coming up with some sort of consensus.
So you share it with the board?
Oh, absolutely.
So, yeah, this is just to follow up with Sharon, and I guess just to a process question. There'll be comment, potentially, as I see, three streams of comments coming in. So there'll be comments that Sharon will receive through her contacts. I've had indication from a couple of GAC members that they've already started receiving comments. Some, I think, have got them all and are just collating and so on. So that will come through soon. And the third one is, you know, my as a the Australian GAC rep, comments from my law enforcement, which I already have. So how does the review team want to receive these? As they come in as a group, should we forward them as we get them? What's going to be useful for the team?
I think if I could just cut to the chase, by all means do share them all if people want that, but I would be in favour of a nice summary and some availability of the raw data for anybody who wants to look at it.
That's very, very wise.
So I'm happy to work with Sharon and the subgroup, and we'll provide a summary, and then there'll be raw data for behind for anyone who wants to drill in. Okay, that's great.
So I think that brings us to time. Thank you very much for staying with it mentally and physically today. That's a tough call after many of us have been on planes. So thank you. I think we've made a great deal of progress this time. I'm really pleased. I'm looking forward to just closing off the discussions on Wednesday afternoon and using that to decide what we do next and how we follow up. But I think we've got a good plan for covering the sessions that are scheduled for Tuesday and Wednesday, and making notes of them and making sure that they're included in our work. So thank you all very much. Kim?
Do we have a team dinner planned sometime during the week?
I think there was Peter asked this as well. I don't think we do, actually, to be quite honest, partly because we don't have any, you know, in London and in San Francisco we had resident team members who very kindly took that on board and made the arrangements, so we don't, but I'm sure we'll have the ability to catch up and have drinks at some point. So thanks a lot, everyone.